Hi, I'm Dirk Hoffmann-Becking, host of the History of the Germans podcast. Like you, I'm a fan of Michael's and of the Scandinavian History podcast, which makes me think you might like my podcast too, in particular now that we've started on season 4, that focuses on the history of the North, and specifically on the Hanseatic League and the Teutonic Knights. Format is familiar, 25 to 35 minute episodes every week on Thursday mornings. The History of the Germans, available everywhere. I hope you come along.
Hi again. Welcome back to the Scandinavian History Podcast with me, Michael Schenkman. Last time, we left Engelbrecht Engelbrektsson at the height of his power and influence. In a few intensive summer months, 1434, he had made quite the career. At the beginning of the year, he had been an obscure member of the lower nobility in the mountainous region of Bergslagen. But by now, he wasn't only the leader of a nationwide Swedish rebellion against the Union King, he was a member of the Council of the Realm. As the icing of the cake, at the meeting at Arboga in January 1435, he had also been elected captain of the realm, meaning he held supreme command of all military forces in Sweden. 1435 definitely looked to be Engelbrecht Engelbrektsson's year. Today, we'll see how things developed for him and the rebellion he'd led since early summer the previous year. Episode 60, Captain of the Realm. After the meeting at Arboga, King Erik eventually realized he needed to be a little more proactive in his handling of the Swedish question. So he sent a delegation to negotiate under the leadership of the governor of Stockholm, one of the few who had successfully resisted Engelbrecht and his forces the previous summer. As the original leader of the rebellion, the captain of the realm, and a newly elected member of the Council of the Realm, Engelbrecht played a key role. But if you would look closely, you'd see the united Swedish front starting to crack ever so slightly. The high nobility, heavily represented on the council, were eager to settle things with King Erik once he'd been cut down to size. They wanted to put an end to the rebellion when they were still on top, and before things got out of hand. So when King Erik's negotiating team arrived, the Swedes claimed to be willing to accept Erik of Pomerania as their king once more. The only thing he'd have to do was to promise to respect the limits that Swedish law put on royal power, a promise he'd made and ignored in the past. He'd just have to mean it this time. Members of the Danish and Swedish Council of the Realm, so representatives of the most influential noble families in the two kingdoms, also met in Halmstad, then in northern Denmark, today on the Swedish west coast. On May 3rd, they issued a joint statement reiterating the Swedish position. The Swedes would accept Erik as king on certain conditions. He would have to govern according to Swedish law in Sweden. The key roles on the Council of the Realm, somewhat anachronistically you could call them the Commander-in-Chief and the Minister of Justice and Finance rolled up into one, should be reappointed. The king had held these powers for himself since the last office holders died in Margaret's days. They also demanded that tax levels should be agreed upon between the king and council. In addition, there were some provisions about granting lands to Engelbrecht himself, as well as to Erik Pukke, who had become a central character in the rebellion. Surely you remember Erik Pukke, right? He was the son of the law speaker of Uppland, the first member of the high nobility to join Engelbrecht's rebellion. By the way, the Swedish delegation at Halmstad was led by none other than our old friend the Archbishop of Uppsala, Olof Larsson. He had returned from his exile in January 1435 to take up his office as archbishop, much to King Erik's chagrin, no doubt. To celebrate the return of the archbishop, a grand victory party was held at Uppsala on June 7th. It was both the consecration of the new and current cathedral in Uppsala, and a celebration of Olof Larsson's appointment, and, at least implicitly, victory over the king and his candidate, who had fled when Engelbrecht and his forces had taken Uppsala the previous summer. The new cathedral was dedicated to Saint Erik, and the reign of the saintly king was also seen as a mythical era, when all was well and the king was just. Unlike Erik of Pomerania, who people definitely felt fell short in this regard. Saint Erik had fought foreign heathens in Finland, and Archbishop Olof, had stood up against a foreign king. The religious and the national aspects of the celebration were intertwined, and a not-too-subtle middle finger to the king in Copenhagen. The Swedish Council of the Realm met at Uppsala, not only for the party, but for a formal council session as well, where they confirmed the decisions from Halmstad and added that anyone who joined the king's side against the Halmstad agreement would be treated as a traitor. They also decided that all Swedes working for foreign lords, including King Eric's foreign governors and commanders of castles, were obligated to leave their service and instead serve the realm so that, with God's help and Saint Eric's, the realm once again could attain its true liberty and dignity. That was not only a provocation against the king, it was a smart move to undermine his power. Under the terms of the current truce, they weren't allowed to attack the castles held by King Eric's loyal foreign commanders, but many of the common soldiers and others who manned and operated these castles were local Swedes. If you were to remove them, it would become well-nigh impossible to keep control over the castles. So maybe it's not all that surprising that King Eric was suspicious of the Swedish proclamations that they were willing to accept his renewed rule and be his loyal subjects once again. And King Eric's confidence in the honest intention of the Swedes certainly wasn't strengthened by their next move. The rebels contacted representatives for the Hanseatic League, offering Lübeck and Danzig and other Hanseatic cities toll-free trade in and with Sweden. The problem with that was that the rebels couldn't really deliver on what they offered, since King Eric controlled the key port cities. And since this trade arrangement flew in the face of King Eric's policy vis-a-vis the Hansa, he could block any Swedish trade with Hanseatic merchants. So nothing came of this initiative, except that King Eric's popularity took yet another hit, especially among the miners in Bergslagen who were dying to export their iron to Germany. The Swedish rebels even pleaded for the Hansa to help them in their struggle against King Eric, but they got a cool response. The Hanseatic League wasn't interested in interfering in some Swedish insurrection. They wanted to deal with the king of the Kalmar Union. But the rebellion in Sweden did strengthen their hand in their negotiations with the king. In July, Eric and several Hansa cities signed a treaty, which had to be seen as a defeat for the king. Eric had to reconfirm the old privileges of the Hanseatic merchants in Scandinavia, granting Hanseatic cities an exemption from the sound dues, seriously reducing the income from the toll. He also had to agree to let Count Adolf of Holstein keep all of Schleswig for life. Under the terms of the truce they had reached at the end of the previous episode, King Eric was expected to return to Stockholm in the second half of 1435 to settle the conflict with the Swedish rebels. But due to the negotiations with the Hansa, Eric didn't arrive in Stockholm until September. Not only was he late, he must have also been in a foul mood after the diplomatic fiasco against the German merchants. So the talks with the Swedes were far from cordial. It probably didn't help that the head of the Swedish delegation was none other than the Archbishop of Uppsala, Olof Larsson, whom Eric had done so much to replace. But in the end, the two sides did reach an agreement on October 14th. The king accepted the Halmstad decree, with a few tweaks. The Swedes had to concede to letting Eric place foreign commanders on three castles in Sweden, Stockholm, Nyköping, and Kalmar. These were the three strongest ones, all controlling key port cities on the Baltic Sea coast. If there was a conflict between the king and council regarding who was to command any other castle, the king would merely be obliged to listen to the council, not follow their advice. The king was free to appoint anyone he wanted to, as long as it was a Swede and not a foreigner. The king was also allowed to once again reduce the number of members of the council, and he exercised that right immediately. That meant that both Engelbrecht Engelbrektsson and Erik Pukke once again were out. But the king did have to appoint a new commander-in-chief and a combined finance and justice minister from among the members who were left on the council. The king chose Christer Nilsson Vasa for the latter position, making him the head of the national bureaucracy in Sweden. It was a logical choice, since Vasa was old and experienced, and the king's ally. For commander-in-chief, the king chose a young man, a new council member, called Karl Knutsson Bunde. He was related to Vasa, so the king probably hoped that his friend and ally would be able to control his young relative on the council. As we'll see, that would prove to be a miscalculation. The October 1435 agreement was very much an elite deal between the king and the council. The complaints from the peasants, the complaints that had started the rebellion to begin with, were hardly even addressed, except when the Swedish delegation needed rhetorical ammunition against King Erik. When push came to shove, they forgot about the peasantry and instead prioritized safeguarding their own interests. Much like the Hansa, they had used the rebellion as leverage against the king to advance their own positions. They did reduce the tax burden slightly, but not by much, and nothing was done to bring abusive governors and other administrators to justice. Engelbrecht didn't like the deal, perhaps because the people he fought for and with for so many months were ignored and brushed aside, but perhaps also because his own position was reduced from council member and captain of the realm to a mere commander of Örebro Castle. And Engelbrecht wasn't the only one who didn't like the deal. When the new commander of the Kastellholm Castle in the Åland Archipelago arrived to take up his position, he'd been given by the king, Erik Pukke, who had captured the castle during the rebellion, didn't accept handing it over to one of the king's men, even though he was Swedish. Instead, he threw the newly appointed commander in jail. But as far as King Erik was concerned, the whole mess with the Swedish rebellion was finally put to bed. The king departed Stockholm on November 1st and sailed back to Copenhagen. He left the running of Sweden in the hands of the council, and especially Christer Nilsson Vasa and Karl Knutsson Bonde, his allies on the council. One of their first tasks was to negotiate with the peasantry north of Lake Mälaren regarding the taxes. The peasants weren't happy with the proposed tax levels outlined in the October deal with the king. They found the reduction too modest, and they rejected it in far from diplomatic terms. The young Karl Knutsson wrote to the king reporting the difficult situation he and the rest of the council were in, and how the peasants resented them. He even warned of a risk for renewed unrest in many regions. From the council's reports to the king, we learn that by now the crack in the Swedish front had widened into an abyss between the council on one side and Engelbrecht and Erik Pukke on the other. The two men were suspected of agitating against both the king and the council. Erik Pukke's father, the law speaker of Uppland, had recently died, and Erik Pukke probably had expected to take his seat on the council. He was passed over, and it had angered him, possibly enough to make him try to reignite the rebellion. The council wanted to regain control over the increasingly volatile situation, so they called another meeting in Arboga, 12 days after Christmas, so in January 1436. There, they would once again discuss the tax levels and why the king's men hadn't been punished, only sacked, for their abuse of the Swedish peasantry. And this time, the peasants were actually going to be represented at the meeting. Engelbrecht had insisted on having them there, officially because the topics to be discussed concerned them, but at least partly also because a throng of angry and armed farmers would strengthen his position considerably. He wasn't a member of the council anymore, but he could still represent the peasants as the leader of the opposition. And the pressure the peasants applied paid off. On January 11th, 1436, less than 3 months after they had signed their agreement with the king, the Swedish Council of the Realm sent a letter to King Erik renouncing their oaths of loyalty to him once again, unless a list of new demands were met within 5 weeks. They wanted the king to deal with the tax and justice situation and give the council members enough authority and resources to deal with any escalation of violence. The 5-week grace period can hardly have been meant to be taken seriously. It was far too short. By the time the letter finally reached the king, most of those 5 weeks had already passed, and even if Erik had written back the same day agreeing to everything, it would have been tricky to get the response back on time in the Scandinavian midwinter. And the Swedes, once again led by Engelbrecht Engelbrektsson and Erik Pukke, had no intention to wait for the king's response. They gathered a force and marched on Stockholm more or less as soon as the ultimatum had been sent off to Copenhagen. Karl Knutsson Bonde felt he needed to join them, if only to keep an eye on things and at least pretend that the council was still in charge. When the force reached Stockholm, the gate was shut and locked. The rebels demanded to be let in, but the two German mayors who greeted them refused to grant them entry and told them to go away. Then Engelbrecht's men tried to force their way in through the gate, but the garrison managed to close and lock the gate and man the tower and walls in preparation for a storming attempt. But then the population of Stockholm rose up against the Danish soldiers and broke the gate lock from the inside, flinging the city gate open to Engelbrecht, Karl Knutsson and the Swedish troops. Street fighting ensued, where the Danish garrison tried to defend the walls and city, but they were driven back, attacked by both the local population and Engelbrecht's forces. In the end, they lost the city and had to retreat to the castle. The German mayors were deposed and replaced by Swedes who sympathized with the rebels. At this point, with the city of Stockholm in rebel hands, but the castle still held by men loyal to the king, the 5-week grace period given to the king ended. Since the king hadn't responded by giving in to all their demands, a new captain of the realm was to be elected. Engelbrecht expected to win the election. This was his rebellion, after all. But he was in for an unpleasant surprise. The re-expanded council chose Karl Knutsson Bonde instead. He won by a whopping 25 of 30 votes. Engelbrecht only got a handful of votes. The high nobility was once again closing ranks, trying to keep control over the development by appointing one of their own as the leader of the rebellion. They were wary of Engelbrecht, a lowly provincial nobleman, and his power over the populace. From their perspective, Karl Knutsson was a much better choice, since he was one of them, belonging to one of the richest families in the land, which is ironic since his family name Bonde actually means peasant in Swedish. But anyway, this time the council had overplayed their hand. Engelbrecht was furious at having been pushed aside, and so were the troops who had taken Stockholm from the Danes. So the council realized they had to backtrack, at least partially. They appointed Engelbrecht co-captain of the realm, equal to Karl Knutsson. Once that compromise was reached, Engelbrecht went on a recruiting campaign throughout Sweden to raise more troops and to convince the people to rise against the Union King yet again. If he'd be able to capture any castles still held by troops loyal to the king, that would be a nice bonus. Engelbrecht and his force marched south and took Blekinge, which technically was a part of Denmark. Then they turned west and attacked Halland, which also was Danish at the time. Scania, the region between Blekinge and Halland, declared itself neutral again, so the Scanians were spared a visit from Engelbrecht and his rebel army. They continued up along the west coast instead, capturing towns and castles as they went. But the campaign had to be cut short because Engelbrecht suddenly fell ill and was brought back to his own castle in Örebro in central Sweden, where he arrived in late April. While in Örebro, the law speaker of Närke, the region where Örebro is the principal city, paid the sick Engelbrecht's son a visit. It wasn't a regular courtesy call on a prominent leader who was ill. No, the law speaker and Engelbrecht were in the middle of a conflict, partly because Engelbrecht's ally, Erik Puke, had captured one of the law speaker's estates, and partly because the law speaker's son had served under Engelbrecht during the early part of the rebellion, but they'd fallen out over something or other. The law speaker wanted to settle their issues, and the two men agreed to let the Council of the Realm adjudicate at its next meeting, which was coming up soon. A week or so later, on May 4th, Engelbrecht left Örebro to go back to Stockholm. He still wasn't well, and had probably preferred to stay in Örebro to recuperate for a little while longer. But the Council of the Realm was meeting, and not only was he a council member again, he wanted to be there for the discussion about the law speaker's complaint. Since the road network in medieval Scandinavia wasn't much to write home about, Engelbrecht traveled by boat as much as possible. Luckily for him, you can travel almost all the way from Örebro to Stockholm on lakes and streams. The first night, Engelbrecht and his entourage set up camp on the shore of Lake Hjälmaren, not far from the law speaker's castle. And when his son approached the camp with a few men of his own, Engelbrecht got up to greet him, probably believing the law speaker had sent his son to invite Engelbrecht and his entourage to spend the night at the castle instead of under the open sky. But he was wrong. As Engelbrecht limped over, supporting himself on a stick, the young man first hurled abuse at him, then whipped out an axe. Engelbrecht held up a hand to protect himself from the blow, and had 3 fingers sliced off. Then he turned to flee, but he didn't stand a chance. His assailant lunged for him and buried his axe at the back of Engelbrecht's neck. A 3rd blow cracked open his skull, and he fell dead on the shore. All the members of Engelbrecht's entourage, including his shocked wife, were rounded up and brought to the castle as prisoners. The following morning, the rumor of the murder spread quickly. Engelbrecht was popular and people were outraged. A mob gathered and spontaneously marched on the castle where the law speaker and his murderous son lived. The mob demanded blood, but both the law speaker and his son managed to escape before the furious peasants showed up. The people then went to collect Engelbrecht's body, which was still lying by the lake where he had fallen. They carried him back to Örebro, where he was buried. The members of the high nobility may have hoped that Engelbrecht would fade into oblivion once he was dead, but the opposite happened. Now that he was dead, he became a symbol of liberty and the fight against tyranny. A cult of his person, almost like a secular saint, developed soon after his death, with legends, poems, and a chronicle being written to glorify him and his struggle for the people of Sweden against the wicked King Eric of Pomerania and his foreign agents. The fact that Engelbrecht was murdered by a nobleman has also turned him into a symbol of class struggle and the fight for the little man against a rigged system and an oppressive elite. To Swedish nationalist politicians and historians throughout the centuries, Engelbrecht was a symbol of Swedish nationalism, fighting for the nation against the Danes. In the early 20th century, he became a symbol for democracy, when that meeting at Arboga in 1435, when he was elected captain of the realm, was interpreted as the first time the traditional Swedish parliament with its four estates was convened. Yes, I said four. In Sweden, the peasantry was represented with an estate of its own. The current Swedish parliament, the Riksdag, even celebrated its 550th anniversary in 1985 based on this interpretation of the Arboga meeting. The only problem is that this understanding of events is based on the assumption that there's a typo in the chronicle describing the meeting. It's much more likely that the peasants weren't actually represented as an estate at Engelbrecht's election. But there have also been negative interpretations of Engelbrecht. Some people with pan-Scandinavian preferences have seen him as someone who fought against a united Scandinavia, and he prolonged the Hanseatic dominance over Scandinavia for generations. Just as King Eric was about to break the Hansa power, the argument goes, Engelbrecht's rebellion shifted the balance of power back to the Germans. Here, the speculations about Engelbrecht's German roots that I mentioned last time also play a part. This view of Engelbrecht as a pro-German actor was extra loaded after the Second World War, when Denmark and Norway had just been liberated from modern-day German occupation, which colored the interpretation of German influence over Scandinavia in the Middle Ages. In that light, Engelbrecht became a traitor to the Scandinavian cause. But, as is so often the case, the real-life Engelbrecht Engelbrektsson was a much more nuanced and arguably interesting character than the symbol he turned into. He led a popular revolt, but he was hardly a member of the proletariat, and he had no problem cooperating with the high nobility and the Council of the Realm when it suited him, especially when he was allowed to join it. He demanded lower taxes and royal bureaucrats who would respect the law, but he wasn't interested in any social revolution, and if he had retained his seat on the Council of the Realm and his position as captain of the realm, it's highly unlikely he'd reignited the rebellion in early 1436. Connected to the question of how to interpret Engelbrecht and his deeds is the question of his murder. Was it merely the result of a hot-headed nobleman whose ego had been bruised by the leader of the people? Was Engelbrecht murdered because he hadn't paid enough respect to his social superiors? Or was it perhaps a politically motivated assassination, contracted by the high nobility that was getting nervous about Engelbrecht's power and his influence over the people? Were they afraid he'd let the populace loose against them next, and decided to eliminate him before he had a chance to act against their interests? To be clear, there is no proof to support such speculation, but many on the Council of the Realm probably found Engelbrecht's death convenient. It took a few days for the news of the murder to reach Stockholm. It was probably met with mixed feelings. On the one hand, as I just mentioned, few people on the Council of the Realm wept for Engelbrecht. But on the other, the council members realized that the murder could have a destabilizing effect, since he'd been so loved by the people, and he'd been murdered by a Swedish nobleman. A meeting was hastily called, where representatives of the farmers would be present as well. There, the council hoped to placate them by convincing them that their complaints about taxes and criminal governors weren't forgotten just because Engelbrecht was dead. They also wanted to assure the assembled representatives of the peasants that Engelbrecht's murderer would be punished. Archbishop Olav was the highest-ranking man at the meeting, and it was held on his home turf in Uppsala. But the man who would come to dominate the proceedings was somebody else, Karl Knutsson Bonde, the man who had been elected captain of the realm instead of Engelbrecht, but who then had to share the title with the now-dead hero of the people. As I mentioned before, Karl Knutsson was young at the time, in his 20s. King Erik had thought he was loyal to the crown, and that's why he'd given Karl Knutsson an important role on the council. Not only did Karl Knutsson belong to one of the oldest and most important noble families in the land, but his wife did as well. She came from one of those aristocratic families with roots both in Sweden and Denmark, and she owned several hundred farms all over Scania, Halland, and southern Sweden. Karl Knutsson himself also owned a similar amount of farms, so he was one of the richest men in Sweden. Karl Knutsson almost immediately ran into problems with the gathered farmers at the meeting in Uppsala. He didn't have the common touch Engelbrecht had possessed, which had been such an important part of his appeal. Karl Knutsson was an aristocrat through and through. His priorities were to gain leadership of the Swedish nobles and to make a deal with King Erik, not to please the peasants. Some would eventually even blame Karl Knutsson for Engelbrecht's death. There's no evidence to prove it, of course, but he did stand to gain from the fact that his co-captain of the realm had died. And even if he hadn't ordered the murder, he may have protected the murderer. For the record, there is a small chance that the murderer did in fact pay a fine to Engelbrecht's relatives in compensation for the murder. We don't know for sure whether he did or not, because so few medieval Swedish documents have survived to our time. We'll get back to why that is in a future episode, so stay tuned for that. But even if he did pay a fine, he wasn't jailed, and he certainly wasn't executed, as I'm sure most of Engelbrecht's followers would have expected. The murderer even ended up as law speaker of Närke, just like his father before him. Anyway, after the far from universally successful meeting in Uppsala, yet another meeting was held in Kalmar later that summer, starting on St. Olaf's Day, July 29th, to be precise. This time, it was the leading members of the Danish and Swedish aristocracy that got together to try and reach a long-term agreement about how the union was to be governed, and by whom. The Swedish delegation, headed by Archbishop Olav Larsson and Christer Nilsson Vasa, the leading man on the Swedish Council of the Realm, pushed for the king to accept their demands for a revised union charter in order to recognize him as king again. The Swedes demanded that the king should have to spend 4 months of the year in each of the three kingdoms, and when he stayed in another kingdom, a viceroy, picked from the Council of the Realm, would govern in his name. Wherever the king was, he should be escorted by at least two members of the three Councils of the Realm, so that all three kingdoms and their respective interests would be represented at court at all times, avoiding a too one-sided Danish coterie of decision-makers. Even though all three kingdoms would still be obligated to participate in defensive wars, the king would not be allowed to start any offensive wars without the consent from all three councils. So in other words, no more adventures in Schleswig without Swedish consent. The Swedes even demanded that taxes collected in Sweden only should be spent in Sweden or for the benefit of Sweden. They also reiterated the old demand that only Swedish-born men should be given commands over Swedish castles. To begin with, the Danish nobles supported the king against the Swedes, but as usual, Erik's lack of diplomatic skills got in his way. He managed to alienate his Danish allies by insisting that his cousin, Duke Bogislav of Pomerania, should be recognized as his heir to the three Scandinavian crowns. Nobody wanted Bogislav except King Erik, so the Swedish and Danish nobles could unite in their resistance to Bogislav. The Danes switched sides at the late stage in the negotiations, siding with the Swedes and their demands for a revised union charter. So the new treaty that was signed in Kalmar on September 1st was far more favorable to the Swedes than it would have been if the king had handled negotiations more deftly. Erik was once again recognized as king also in Sweden, but he would have to limit his power to those awarded to him by Swedish law, thus strengthening the council. But the Swedes didn't get all they asked for, and they certainly didn't get their own Swedish budget. The renewal of the union was celebrated with a quintessentially medieval ceremony of reconciliation on the main square in front of Kalmar Cathedral, where Erik had been crowned 39 years before. The church bells rang out as if they were warning of an approaching storm, calling the people to the square. There, they found the Swedish nobles kneeling, begging the king's forgiveness for having turned away from him. Erik then took them by the hand, one by one, and raised them onto their feet again, symbolizing that he forgave them. Peace had returned once more, and everyone was happy, at least the king and everyone in the council of the realm. But just like the previous agreements, this new treaty only addressed the conflict between the nobility and the king, ignoring the problems of the broader masses. The issue of the tax levels and the punishment of previous governors were once again postponed for future talks, to the dismay of the peasantry. It's unclear why they thought ignoring the peasants would work this time. Maybe because their number one champion, Engelbrecht, was dead and could no longer stir up trouble. But if King Erik and the nobility thought that the peasants would fail to notice that they were once again ignored, they were sorely mistaken. The peasants were not happy, and as far as they were concerned, peace had not returned. On the contrary, the storm clouds would soon be gathering again, and next time a new storm will break over King Erik's head. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Scandinavian History Podcast. If you did, why not spread the word wherever you congregate with others who are into Scandinavian history? Also, please consider leaving a stellar review, or at least 5 stars, on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, where you can rate podcasts nowadays. This is an excellent way to attract new listeners and to support the show. Another good way to support the show is to purchase some Scandinavian history-themed merch in the Scandinavian History Podcast webshop. I especially recommend something from the Odin's Lifehack collection. It's a line of merch with quotes from Havamal, accredited to the King of the Gods. You can get t-shirts, mugs, tote bags, and many other items with nuggets of Scandinavian wisdom, such as, "Wake up early if you want another man's land or life," "Only fools hope to live forever by avoiding enemies," or "Speak useful words or be silent." Links to these amazing products and more can be found on the Scandinavian History Podcast Facebook page or on Twitter. If you haven't already, then please go to facebook.com/Scandinavian History Podcast. Like and follow the page if you want to shop or if you just crave more content at least vaguely related to Scandinavian history. Via the Facebook page, you can also send me questions or angry messages about things I've said or not said on the show. If you prefer Twitter, then you can follow me and send me messages at Schenkman. That's S-H-A-I-N-K-M-A-N. I look forward to hearing from you.